This is the 22nd anniversary Jellicle Guild meeting. It was my obligatory anecdote now. And this is the first time I've done this since in the East Coast since 2001, so that's kind of neat. I haven't told this anecdote on this side of the continent. So back in the 80s, when there was no internet, if you didn't live in a big city or were near a big city, you were kind of stuck with who and what was around you.
That's the way to put it.
Yeah.
You mean it's changed?
Yeah, well, I hear tell. I was fortunate enough, however, while being stuck in the middle of nowhere, so it seemed, to nonetheless know a lot of really cool people who play guitar, wrote poetry, so on and so forth. And we would just get together at each other's houses. We apparently didn't know it was the 80s and you were supposed to smoke cocaine and drive fast cars, because most of us weren't hippies, but we had that sort of vibe of, you know, smoke pot and play guitar and read poetry. And then I read this book called The Inklings by Humphrey Carpenter, which told the story of this literary group back around World War II. There were a lot of literary groups. They were in England at Cambridge and Oxford universities. They were little groups of scholars and professors who basically they'd repair to the local pub and they'd read each other's works. Among them was this group that called itself the Inklings, which had in it J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings, and C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, and several other people that were sort of kind of famous in their own right. And it was the story of them and their group over the course of years. And I thought, well, why can't we have something like that? And so eventually we found Roma Restaurant in New Britain, which was a sort of a Polish-Italian restaurant of sorts, kind of a local dive. Not even a dive, a local family bar. But family bar, that's a funny phrase. Bring the whole family.
It was a completely Polish restaurant.
It started out as Italian, that's why it was called Roma. And then the Polish guys, two Polish guys bought it.
Really weird.
And then what they did was they added Polish fare to the menu while leaving the grinders and the spaghetti and stuff. So it was kind of a hybrid. And they had in the back room a dining room that after about 8 o'clock was empty. And we discovered that we could go back there, and as long as we kept buying some drinks and buying food and just sort of generally, as long as saw money coming in from the back room every so often,
you loved it.
Then so basically, I had the idea, but then now I have my location and I already knew the people. So you have the people, the idea, and the location, and all mixed up together, and suddenly we were doing something nobody else was doing in that area, and we did it at that place for it was 8 times a year. For 13 years.
Wow. Well,
and it was amazing. And what's funny is that from 92 to 2001, for 9 years or 10 years there, I was actually living in Boston. I wasn't living around New Britain anymore. So I would get on the Greyhound 8 months out of the year and take my bus down, and Jim would meet me at the Hartford station, and then we'd go off and have our gathering. They were more drunken than these latter day ones are. But they were lots of fun. They were good spirited, and nobody felt.
They started out sober.
Having you here, Jim, it seduces me into dragging this out. I don't mean to, but there were a lot of good times. There were a lot of good times.
Just think of the good times.
And no bad times, hopefully.
Well, yeah, there were those. There were those, but I think there were more. I think there were way more good times, and I think my focus.
We get a bunch of people together, obviously, once in a while, you know, come up with a disagreement, conflicting point of view.
But the thing of it is that everybody pretty much knew. Everybody pretty much knew that the gatherings were something special, which was nice because there weren't anything like them. And there weren't a lot of other options at that time because there was no internet to. I mean, you were basically. When I say you're stuck with the people around you, that's for good or for bad. I mean, you know, you can make something of that, which is what we tried to do. But anyway, so we held our meeting there for 13 years, and then we had the last meeting in 2001. And then I moved out west not long thereafter, and. But I kept thinking about it, and I think I said this last time. I was thinking, well, can you have a Jellicle Guild if you have different people? And we had meetings out west that they were fun for what they were with the people who came, the residual benefit was that I learned some of the stuff that like this technical stuff was stuff I first experimented with out there.
Right.
Like having people phone in and I wanted Jim to come, and Jim was far away, and he was like, "Oh, the Jellicle Guild is existing, and I'm 3,000 miles from it." And there was pain in his voice.
And I could not possibly get out there.
Right. So one time we had a meeting where we had him call in, and he gave a 20-minute transcontinental telephonic conference. Telephonic concert, rather.
Concert,
not conference. And that was really good. That, you had a circle of people sitting there listening to you play, and it was different, you know.
Yeah,
it was fun.
That's for sure. Yeah,
it was a way to, you know, jack you in. I just wanted to start it up again because I just missed it, and you know, time had passed. So to begin, I am going to read a poem to start with Jim's accompaniment, I hope. So, Season of Lights. It wasn't years ago, like many of these stories know. There was no full moon, as often is my light. I'm not telling one more story of fine ass and tryptamines because I can. These are my hours. This is what I do with them. There was pain, but it was not the stuff of music. And I caused as much as I got. Was it reaction? Was it revenge? What isn't in this world in one way or another? But there it was, not long ago enough to be long ago, merely ago. I sat alone with many others, and these were neither friends nor enemies. And I worked, and we worked, and nothing we made mattered. These hours weren't even pretty enough to be ugly. What then about this? Why remember it to this page? It was because I looked up, suddenly, and nobody saw me do it. Looked up and at something. Was it an insect flashing by, tiny and up here on the 20th floor? It was, and nobody noticed, but I did not look down. I watched it, this visible buzzing, watched it for how it did not belong here, and yet here it was. Dissatisfied, thrown, now restless to know more. Yet what book or which teacher, what great human path of knowing would explain? None. I knew this. None would explain. That's how I ended up here. None explains. And for a long time, it hadn't mattered anymore. I had my work alone and among many others. I had a chamber, a cupboard of food, a deck of cards, and a body to fuck every night. None explained, but I no longer knew or cared. Now I did, and I had to know, or at least I had to look up again new. And so I stood up and left my desk, my work, and climbed the 20 flights down to the street, a mid-morning of drizzle and hustlers with begging signs. I walked the streets thinking, how do I unlearn all I no longer know? How do I do this? I'm telling you about something still fresh, not an old tale with all that came after. None explains, but I had to know. And so, here I sit with you, no cup, no line to pedal. I sit before you on this street corner, a shout's distance from that great tree of lights, and I do not know. None explains. But I ask you now, sit with me. Sit with me here, a minute, an hour. We don't have to speak. Sit with me. We'll look at the lights. We'll watch the faces. We'll wonder high and low, because that's what humans do. We don't have to speak, but we may find we are singing. We'll feel the drizzle, the great miracle of doubt, and the love.
Carnival season rears its mad masked head just before Ash Wednesday, the austere first day of the Roman Catholic 40-day Lenten fast. Carnival, whether lasting 3 days as it does in most places or 2 weeks as it does in a few looser locales, culminates on Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday with particularly riotous merrymaking. The commonly accepted view is that Carnival originated as a final fling on the part of good Christians before they commenced their 40 days of fasting and penitence in preparation for Easter. It is written in encyclopedias and taught in universities that the word carnival is derived from the Latin carne lavare, meaning the putting away of flesh. Thus, it is thought to refer to some festive last-minute pre-Lenten carnivorousness, for during Lent none of the faithful may eat meat. Poppycock, balderdash, and flapdoodle. In other words, bullshit. The carnival celebrated in Catholic lands is actually an adaptation of an ancient pagan whoop-de-doo-hoo, the festival of Dionysus, which in turn was adapted from the still older Haloa and Thesmophoria, two of the fertility festivals of the mother goddess Demeter. In classical Greece, at the time when paternal rule began to ace out maternal, newcomer Dionysus was elevated to the Olympic Council, replacing the earth goddess Hestia and taking over Demeter's festivals. For untold thousands of years before, there had been no male deities in Europe. Dionysus, incidentally, was originally associated with psychedelic mushrooms, first the Amanita muscaria.
That's true.
And you say that's true because I told you that's true.
But I also read it elsewhere.
You looked it up. Okay,
good. First the Amanita muscaria, and later the smoother, more delightful psilocybe. As the paternalistic Christian influence gained power, Dionysus was purged of his mushroom practices and was pronounced the god of wine. The church and the political and business interests who found Christianity a perfect front much preferred the masses to use booze, which depresses the senses, instead of mushrooms, which illuminate them. Just as they preferred that the aggressive logic of the paternal stereotype supplant the loving grace of maternalism. If kissing is man's greatest invention, then fermentation and patriarchy compete with the domestication of animals for the distinction of being man's worst folly. And no doubt the three combined long ago, the one growing out of the others to foster civilization and lead Western humanity to its present state of decline. Cha-cha-cha. In truth, the word carnival is derived from Carus Navalis, cart of the sea. This was a boat-shaped vehicle on wheels used in the processions of Dionysus, and from which all kind of witty and lust-inducing songs were sung. These ship carts, Carry Novalis, making references as they did to Dionysus's fabled underwater retreat in the grottos of the sea, in the grottos of the sea goddess Thetis, from which he emerged at festival time, were accompanied by musicians and dancers of both sexes, skimpily clad or nude. They continued to be pulled through the streets in European festivals until the later Middle Ages, and today have their less nautical and less naughty counterparts in Mardi Gras floats. This is all very informative.
That is very informative.
The pagan festivals were deeply entrenched in the hearts of and minds of the people, and they were inclined to give them up. Substitute the cross of guilt and suffering for the sea cart of joy and fecundity? Somehow that didn't seem like an A1 good deal. They ran it up a flagpole, and only a few paranoiacs and uncontrolled spastics saluted it. So the church shrewdly compromised. It promoted carnival, but conspired to give it Christian significance, gradually seceding in divorcing it from carefree fertility and associating it instead with self-denial and death. Albeit, at least at 3 days, the shortest death in history, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. And as Jesus himself once said, you're either Forrest or a Guinness.
John Maciag was all bone, knees, elbows, and jaw. Hated his rifle, proficient at killing, wanted home so badly it burned his soul. We leaned up that mountain near Yangoo, frightened. War's hurricane tore our ranks, trees of us lifted by roots. I came running down 3 days later. Like cordwood, the bodies were stacked between two stakes, all Korean, but that jaw of John Maciag I saw, a log of birch amongst the scrub. I stopped. The sergeant said, move on. I said, maybe never. I'm going to sit and think about John Maciag's forever, whose fuel he is, what the flames of him will light. Perhaps he'll burn the glory of God or man. Yes. This is from my new novel in progress, an excerpt that's called The Gluten-Free Gorilla, G-U-E-R-I, well, two R's, I guess, I-L-L-I, cooking book. And this is not a recipe, but there are some recipes in it. Some of them made up and some of them are real. So anyway, this is called Leaves. So it's interspersed with her, it's a novel, so. Leaves. This fall is the first where the leaves have been aggressive. They threaten and bully, and images of Hitchcock's The Birds come to mind. The first was a large oak leaf on my windshield. The wipers cleared the other leaves, but this mottled yellow assailant dashed towards us and held on, blocking part of the view on the passenger side. It clung for blocks, knocking on the windshield as though trying to commandeer my car. This was the first, but since then I have seen gangs of leaves, not floating through the air as they do every fall in New England, but setting up a howl, gathering strength and flying at things, at windows, people, dogs and cats, stairwells. Yesterday at work, during a meeting, the leaves swept violently at a bank of windows along the conference room, banging, challenging, demanding. What? Whatever leaves can demand or want. Their intentions have not been clear, just their intentness. They are not discarded. They are entities in themselves. They have risen. They are to be reckoned with. They will not be disregarded. One clear message does abide. This leaf movement is a harbinger of things to come. Nature will not be overlooked this time. As gentle as it has become through global warming, it will now and then occasionally churn up a tsunami and overtake an island or two, or reinvent a shoreline. It is no respecter of persons, of place, of life. It is restless, mindlessly moving, yet with purpose.
Holy crap. I read that my jaw fell
open. Those leaves, man. Yeah.
Those leaves.
They'll attack you.
They'll get you.
You got it.
They'll attack you.
I've been considering lately the idea of expecting one person to come forward and change the world of men and women. A leader, a hero, a master. Not influence matters, shift things, some, kick off deep rust, but change the world. I don't think this hope is unique to this time or any part of the world. And it's true there are those that cause change, small and large, and the world does seem to change because of a given individual's decision or actions. What then? Is the helplessness persons feel among each other to breach the gap between one soul and another? Not by moments, flashes, but ongoing, a process assembled for understanding, perpetual empathy. The tries are ambitious. The possibilities of LSD, of sex, of spirituality, among many others. The hope that the binding force needed will happen, finally in 2012. Lucid dreaming. Communal living. Are these times more hopeless than others, or seeming so because they are occurring now? I tend to think the latter, having lived long enough to recall distinctly different years when equally many people felt a new age coming, as did those who identified arriving apocalypse. I've come to believe that humans have been struggling with the same matters of society, morality, mystery, and mortality for a long, long time, and coming up with too many imperfect answers. The last piece in the puzzle never fits or is missing. There simply is no agreement on how to live and why, or where from or where to. Suspicions, theories, ideas elaborated as though discovered and confirmed fact, truth revealed. How else to bring up children but to offer a set of valued ideas and approved behaviors? How else to regulate the distribution of land, of goods, of the ways by which societies will best perpetuate themselves? How else to transmit history and determine what cultural artifacts will be preserved to communicate to the future the best of what now was like? How indeed. But what I fall back upon, oddly, is something far more prosaic. And I think it is more often true than not. Is, in fact, transferable and translatable to many times and places. Here's an attempt to say. I'm sitting in a cafe, crowded, but peaceable. I purchased a bottle of sparkling water that is what its label claims it to be. The table I sit at, the chair I sit on, were made by unknown hands, where and when I don't know. My clothes hold their stitches. Nobody presses me to rob my wallet. These facts, such as they are true for everyone else sitting at the tables around me. These things, I believe, are important because there is greater advantage than disadvantage. Not always, but often. The safety of those around me somewhat assures my own. Needless suffering pains most people in most situations. Another's pleasure gives me or you some too, more often than it doesn't. Collaboration feels at least as good as, and often better than, competition. A body lies in crumpled agony in the street. Walk by, call the police, or hurry over to tend this person. If it can be said that most people, in most instances, would call the police or hurry over, then I believe there is genuine hope beyond the appearance of a savior or an omega point date. Is it enough? I don't know. The world is full of suffering, and our damaged race is daily damaging further this only home. But I do believe this, that most of us would hurry over to that crumpled body to tend, to help, to comfort. It is a powerful thing, a hint, a clue, that it's not just the man on the throne or at the pulpit who bear what is most needed. It's the strangers in this cafe, and you reading this page, and countless others. Really, at least maybe. I've known Chris for quite a few years, as someone who lived in New Mexico and who had an interest in philosophy and literature. And we've talked online some in the Spirit Plants chat room, which is a online community. But we never really had any, I mean, aside from me, no, I think we knew each other's interest in books, but we hadn't ever really done anything but had occasional conversations. And then he took a trip down to Peru in pursuit of ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic vine, I guess you'd best
it's
call it.
It's a combination of two things, but it's traditionally known as ayahuasca is just the vine, and it's known as the vine of the souls.
Vine of the soul. So Chris has been a traveler. He lived in India for a while. He's always traveling in search of truths, I would say. And anyway, a couple of years ago, he started posting his journal from down there, down in Peru. He managed to get onto some internet cafes, and I read his writing, and I was like, holy fuck, this guy is good. He's not only having this amazing adventure, but his writing is are aesthetic enough to describe it in a way that is pleasurable and interesting. I mean, everything about this writing is good. It's good writing in every which way. And so I said, I want to publish this in my magazine. Would you be willing to do that? And so over the course of four issues in 2009, we published the entirety of his Peru journal. And then I said, well, the next step is I want to make it into a book. Would you be willing to go that route with me? And so the challenge was that these chapbooks, they don't get that long without, like, this is 75 pages, and this is about as long as this book can get physically. And still fold.
Yeah.
And his Peru journal was probably twice that length. So this past summer, while I, among other things I did while I've been unemployed, was I edited his Peru journal down to chapbook length. And a couple of nights ago, Cassie designed the book. So everything that looks good about it in terms of layout and the cover and the back cover, everything that makes the book look good is Cassie's doing. So last night I said, okay, so we're going to debut your book tomorrow night and let's record some of it. So we were on the phone last night. The story thus far is that he and his, I don't think she's his wife, but his companion, whose name is Brandy, but in the book she's called Grateful Bear. They have traveled from New Mexico down to Peru in search of drinking ayahuasca with the shamans down there. Thus far, the story thus far is that they've spent a lot of time chewing coca leaves, which coca leaves are the natural source of cocaine, but they're very different from cocaine, from processed cocaine. They're much deeper experience than what one associates with cocaine. And so finally, the part he's going to be reading from, he's hooked up with a shaman who's willing with him and Grateful Bear and some others, willing to initiate them into the ayahuasca rites.
I'm sorry. Him and who else?
Grateful Bear, who's his girlfriend. Yeah.
And so, dude, I just would like a little background. Sure. Real quick. Does he speak English? I mean,
Chris?
I'm sorry.
Oh, the Shaman.
Does he speak, or how do they communicate?
I think sometimes there's a translator.
Yeah.
A lot of the shamans don't speak English.
Well, shamans, okay.
And so they have like an assistant who's a translator.
Yeah.
But a lot of the...
It's usually like their grandson or something like that, too.
Yeah.
It always works out that way, where it's like a relative or something, or an apprentice.
I think with this particular shaman that they drank with, whose name is Luco, he had a sort of girlfriend / assistant who translated for him.
Oh, all right. Okay.
This is Chris reading...
Tonight we drank ayahuasca, the vine of the soul, for the first time. Exceeding my expectations, ayahuasca's wisdom is only surpassed by the grace and elegance with which it heals the wounded heart. Over the years, I've worked in a range of transformative traditions, including Buddhist meditation, medical science, hatha yoga, and Zen. I've lived in monasteries, meditation centers, and retreated with the likes of Thich Nhat Hanh and Dr. Roshi Joan Halifax. I have filled myself with all manners of intellectual wisdom through books and research articles. I've investigated pharmaceutical science and psychology. The simple truth for me is that ayahuasca blows all of them out of the water. In terms of skill and efficiency, it is unparalleled as a vehicle of healing and spiritual development. A soft and powerful warmth of light, wholly welcoming, passed over me in the initial phases as the medicine began working in my body and mind. As our shaman sang ikaros, or healing songs, over the first several hours, the visions were subsumed within a powerful and reassuring presence. A thick black serpent moving with an elegantly powerful and healing grace, then transforming into a pleroma of colonnades, reaching up into the palm-thatched roof, then dissolving into scintillae of light. You can trust this completely, the medicine said, with a clarity of perception and strength. I am here to heal you. The Icaros brought a lot of light into the first ceremony, and I was completely at home in the trance. Misconceptions I had were dispelled regarding the medicine. Misconception one being that ayahuasca tastes terrible. It's not that bad. I've imbibed things that taste much worse. It tastes kind of like bitter hot chocolate. Misconception two, what they call the, quote, purge, is exclusively physical, i.e. vomiting. What is referred to as the purge is the process by which dense and heavy energies are brought into light and purged from the unconscious. The physical dimension of the purge constitutes a minuscule fraction of the purgative process. This medicine is, in my experience, the planetary healer par excellence, the sine qua non of medicine. The purge is the phenomenological dimension of what ayahuasca truly is. In my first experience, I clearly perceived the light and power of the Icaros as pressing out the dark energies of shame, guilt, and especially doubt. I saw clearly that these energies had established a personality dynamic within me, preventing me from relating to others in a meaningful and sincere way. All of these people are crazy, I would hear in these energies, and see the walls I had erected in coming to know others. A couple things became clear regarding the medicine. First, in the context of the shamanic healing traditions of the Amazon, ayahuasca is seen within a spiritual cosmology. In this cosmology, the vine is directly perceived as a personified and spiritual teacher. So when ayahuasca is referred to as the medicine, it is being designated as a spiritual presence that initiates the neophyte into the various levels and grades of spiritual perception. This is not a matter of rational understanding, as the very substance being purged tends to reside within the unconscious mind. My experience seems to indicate that the more irrational the manner in which ayahuasca tends to be working within one's system, the deeper the purge. This argument extends from the fact that what is most unconscious tends to be that which we are most unaware of, that which does not fit into our current level of conscious understanding. This is not to say that the unconscious is never subject to the rigor of rational thought and reason, simply that what is currently unconscious does not reside within the framework of what is currently rational thought for us. What this perspective emphasizes is that we must be humble to the present moment and surrender the sort of arrogance and hubris that pretends to understand everything, be it scientific or spiritual. Ayahuasca sees beyond the metaphysical assumptions that tend to obfuscate hyper-materialistic, including scientific and hyper-spiritualistic modes of perception. The jungle breathes as a living presence. For a solid hour, I heard an angelic presence singing deep within the forest, compelling me into a period of, quote, reality testing. What is this sound really? Truly, what is this voice deep within the jungle? When the Icaros stopped, the purge began for me, though I didn't vomit. For all of the difficulty of the purge, there's something very beautiful and wonderful about it. Something in me just knew that this was okay, that this was the deepest healing a person could go through. The cosmological framework in which ayahuasca is used reinforces this perception. It gives you exactly what you need, and only so much as you can take. During this period, the medicine posed a question that has since become something of a personal koan for me. Quote, is pursuit of the truth worth all of the suffering and uncertainty? My answer would be yes, but this answer does not penetrate into the depths of the question for me. What this question has become is a clarion call in developing my own faculties of spiritual discernment and investigation. It's not a question with an intellectual answer, but instead one felt directly as an intuitive sense of the nature of the medicine, the purge, and the unconscious mind. What this question showed me through the medicine is my own potential, what the future could be. Specifically, this question allowed me to probe the difficulties that have evolved in my relationship with my father, suggesting a link between my own struggle and my place within the revolution of consciousness as it is being mediated by the medicine. The medicine in the macrocosmic sense of what medicine actually is, and purge in the sense of what the purge actually is, the truth. The medicine is the infinite light of compassion and healing, the one and great spiritual apocalypse that is the central gravity and mystery of life. The purge is the manifestation of the medicine within the time-bound dimension of cause and effect, karmic conditioning, and personal suffering. The light comes to bear on the darkness, and the darkness is purged. The alchemists refer to the central mystery of the path of the wounded healer as the Mysterium Coniunctionis, the Lapis Lazuli, and the Unial Spiritus. The two become one, and we are healed. Where does the purge go? I asked the medicine on the first night. The truth is that the purge and medicine are one. I have finally found my life and destiny. No one understood what I was doing, even mocked it. But this is the story of a man who journeyed deep into the jungle for healing and was healed. A man has the right to heal himself, to stand in his truth. Here I am, as ever standing.
We were wandering around Boston. We were down at the harbor.
Oh, okay.
We had an afternoon together. And we were wandering down at the harbor, and we were just sort of checking stuff out. We were just, you know, kept shooting the shit. And I told him I wanted to record poems, him reading poems, because I knew he wasn't going to be here tonight. Because he's working.
Right.
And he's at his bookstore, and he's putting in a hard shift, because it's Christmas time.
Yeah.
So we went to South Station, but it was too noisy there and too distracting. So we came outside, and he saw these benches, actually at the Federal Reserve of Boston. Of all places, it's this huge building, Federal Reserve of Boston.
They have like couches inside. It looks like a hotel.
It's a very beautiful building, and they have a on the outside. It's across from South Station, and on the outside, on the side, there's a smoker's park.
I'm not just where it is.
There's benches, and there's like this sort of gravelly stuff where you can drop your butts. And there's little smoking like butt receptacles and stuff. He was in heaven. He said he smokes, and he was in heaven. He was so happy. So we found these benches that, and there was like seven. There were a bunch of benches. It was very elaborate. We were speculating that people working for the Federal Reserve probably have to smoke a lot just to keep their sanities. Yeah, and we settled in at the far benches, and he was puffing away and reading from his books that he brought.
Okay, this is by the poet Campbell McGrath, contemporary American poet, who I've recently discovered and like a lot. Maybe you'll see why. Anyhow, well, here's one that's very graphic and might be hard for some people to listen to.
Okay.
So giving it a rating of potential scenes of animal violence, actually. It's pretty graphic, but ultimately it's not sensationalistic. It's serving his purpose. But anyhow,
okay.
Steer yourself for the leatherback.
Ooh.
Okay, the leatherback. I'm still slogging Sam's surfboard across the sand when the boys race off to see what the commotion up the beach is all about. And by the time I get close, they've run back to report. A sea turtle, a leatherback, the biggest of them all. We've never seen one before. But there's a problem. It's injured. They already loaded it into the back of the Fish and Game Department pickup truck as the local cops pointlessly holler to stand back, stand back. And it's truly huge, like an old sequoia log, like the barnacled hull of an overturned rowboat. One of the rangers says it is probably 80 years old, and the boys say its fins are all chopped up by a boat. But the ranger says no, a knife. And now I can see sinewy stumps where the flippers should be. Gray flesh marbled with milk-white fluid. Sickening, I turn away. It must have washed here from some place where turtles are still a food source. The Bahamas are less than 100 miles east. There's a strong wind blowing Portuguese men of war up the beach. Sea turtles eat jellyfish. The tentacles blind them as they age. These waves have brought us all here today. Some surfers already out, others in the crowd talking about the turtle. I'm turning to head back when I see the bad look on Elizabeth's face. Some of the white-haired retirees from the next building are telling her the full story. It crawled from the ocean at dawn. It didn't lay eggs. It didn't swim away. They thought it was odd, old, maybe sick. They called the police. The fishermen from the jetty wandered over to look. One man rode it like a horse before it's clear what happened or why a fishing knife emerges to saw through the rubbery, elephant-thick skin. Three flippers gone before anyone stops him. The senior citizens are shouting out, "Hey, no," accosting him. "What are you doing? Why did you do this?" And he, for soup. Some of the old people are crying. They chase him away. "Get lost. You're crazy. How would you feel if we cut your arm off like that?" Some of the fishermen laughed. Some shook their heads. The police arriving, helpless, uninformed. It's more than I can handle, honestly. I turn away. I'm trembling. Not with anger, but with shame. The ranger truck spins its wheels and bogs down in soft sand, having traveled perhaps 50 feet. It takes an hour before a tractor comes to tow them clear. The giant turtle is that heavy. What is there to say? 80 years old for soup. That milky extrusion, was it blood? As I dive into the water, I am thinking how generous the ocean is in its forgiveness. I am thinking at least I never looked into its eyes.
Damn.
Yeah.
Damn.
So, hold my hammer, the mood is. But this is a guy who, I don't even know how I discovered his name, Spencer Reese. And I don't think he's had many books. And he is assistant manager at Brooks Brothers in Palm Beach. So you say, what? This is a poet? Well, people.
Yeah,
this
pay
is
attention.
This is a poem. And it has, I think, credible pathos for the individual and speaks to the times as well. So, let's see if I can give it a reading here. called The Clerk's Tale. I am 33 and working in an expensive clothier, selling suits to men I call sir. These men are muscled, groomed, and cropped, with wives and families that grow exponentially. Mostly I talk of rep ties and bow ties, of full Windsor knots and half Windsor knots, of Tattersall, French cuff, and English spread collars, of foulards, neats, and internationals, of pincord, houndstooth, nailhead, and sharkskin. I often wear a blue pinstripe suit. My hair recedes and is going gray at the temples. On my cheeks there are a few pimples. For my terrible eyesight, horn-rimmed spectacles. One of my fellow workers is an old homosexual who works hard and wears bracelets with jewels. No one can rival his commission checks. On his break, he smokes a Benson & Hedges cigarette, puffing expectantly as a Hollywood starlet. He has carefully applied a layer of Clinique bronzer to enhance the tan on his face and neck. His hair is gone except for a few strands which are combed across his scalp. He examines his manicured, lacquered nails. I admire his studied attention to details, his tie stuck to his shirt with masking tape, his teeth capped, his breath mint in place. The old homosexual and I laugh in the back over a coarse joke involving an octopus. Our banter is staccato, staged and close, like those Spanish dancers by Granados. I sometimes feel we are in a musical, gossiping backstage between our numbers. He drags deeply on his cigarette. Most of his life is over. Often he refers to himself as, quote, an old faggot, unquote. He does this bemusedly, yet timidly. I know why he does this. He does this because his acceptance is finally complete, and complete acceptance is always bittersweet. Our hours are long, our backs bent. We are more gracious than English royalty. We dart among the aisles, tall as hedgerows. Watch us face into the merchandise. Here we set up and take apart mannequins as if we were performing autopsies. A naked body without pretense is of no use. It grows late. I hear the front metal gates close down. We begin folding the ties correctly according to color. The shirts, oxfords, broadcloths, pinpoints must be sized, stacked, or rehashed. The old homosexual removes his right shoe, allowing his gigantic bunion to swell. There's the sound of cash being countered, coins clinking, bills swishing, numbers whispered, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We are changed when the transactions are done, older, dirtier, dwarfed. A few late customers gawk in at us. We say nothing. Our silence will not be breached. The lights go off one by one, the dressing room lights, the mirror lights. Then it is very late. How late? 11? We move to the gate. It goes up. The gate's grating checkers on our cheeks. This is the Mall of America. The light is bright and artificial, yet not dissimilar to that found in a Gothic cathedral. You must travel down the long hallways to the exits before you encounter natural light. One final formality, the manager checks our bags. The old homosexual reaches into his over-the-shoulder leather bag, the one he bought on his European travels with his companion of many years. He finds a stick of lip balm and applies it to his lips liberally, as if shellacking them. Then he inserts one last breath mint and offers one to me. The gesture is fraternal and occurs between us many times. At last, we bid each other good night. I watch him fade into the many-tiered parking lot, where the thousands of cars have come and are now gone. This is how our day ends. This is how our day always ends. Sometimes snow falls like rice. See us take to our dimly lit exits, disappearing into the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Minneapolis is sleek, and St. Paul, named after the man who had to be shown, is smaller, older, and somewhat withdrawn. Behind us, the moon pauses over the vast egg-like dome of the mall. See us loosening our ties among you. We are alone. There is no longer any need to express ourselves.
All right. Well, this is done. You want to say hello to the Jellicle folks before?
Sure. All right, I'm on now.
You're on.
All right, hello, everyone. Sorry I could not attend this evening, dealing with the Christmas throngs in Brookline. But I wish you all well. I hope you have a good meeting. I hope you enjoy my electronic contribution here. A first for me, perhaps. So, I plan to see you next time. Until then, Godspeed.
Right on.
Love It by Toni Morrison, which is, I think, really one long poem. Mm-hmm. I've often felt that it was one long poem. I mean, it's a novel, but it's really one poem. The character of Beloved connects deeply with, she is the resuscitation or revival of an unspeakable tragedy. A fully dressed woman walked out of the water. She barely gained the dry bank of the stream before she sat down and leaned against a mulberry tree. All day and all night she sat there, her head resting on the trunk in a position abandoned enough to crack the brim in her straw hat. Everything hurt but her lungs most of all. Sopping wet and breathing shallow, she spent those hours trying to negotiate the weight of her eyelids. The day breeze blew her dress dry. The night wind wrinkled it. Nobody saw her emerge or came accidentally by. If they had, chances are they would have hesitated before approaching her. Not because she was wet or dozing or had what sounded like asthma, but because amid all that she was smiling. Okay, so that's
nice.
That's where she emerges. Then
she emerged from a shipwreck.
it's not wrong. It's not right. I mean, it's just you're not too far off.
Yeah.
But so here's like this is like 8/10 into the book. But I am beloved, and she is mine. I see her take flowers away from leaves. She puts them in a round basket. The leaves are not for her. She fills the basket. She opens the grass. I would help her, but the clouds are in the way. How can I say things that are pictures? I am not separate from her. There is no place where I stop. Her face is my own, and I want to be there in the place where her face is, and to be looking at it too, a hot thing. All of it is now. It is always now. There will never be a time when I am not crouching and watching others who are crouching too. I am always crouching. The man on my face is dead. His face is not mine. His mouth smells sweet, but his eyes are locked. Some who eat nasty themselves. I do not eat. The men without skin bring us their morning water to drink. We have none. At night, I cannot see the dead man on my face. Daylight comes through the cracks, and I can see his locked eyes. I am not big. Small rats do not wait for us to sleep. Someone is thrashing, but there is no room to do it in. If we had more to drink, we could make tears. We cannot make sweat or morning water, so the men without skin bring us theirs. One time they bring us sweet rocks to suck. We are all trying to leave our bodies behind. The man on my face has done it. It is hard to make yourself die forever. You sleep short and then return. In the beginning we could vomit. Now we do not. Now we cannot. His teeth are pretty white points. Someone is trembling. I can feel it over there. He is fighting hard to leave his body, which is a small bird trembling. There is no room to tremble. So he is not able to die. My own dead man is pulling away from my face. I miss his pretty white points. We are not crouching now. We are standing, but my legs are like my dead man's eyes. I cannot fall because there is no room to. The men without skin are making loud noises. I am not dead. The bread is sea-colored. I am too hungry to eat it. The sun closes my eyes. Those able to die are in a pile. I cannot find my man, the one whose teeth I have loved, a hot thing. The little hill of dead people, a hot thing. The men without skin push them through with poles. The woman is there with a face I want, the face that is mine. They fall into the sea, which is the color of the bread. She has nothing in her ears. If I had the teeth of the man who died on my face, I would bite the circle around her neck, bite it away. I know she does not like it. Now there is room to crouch and to watch the crouching others. It is the crouching that is now always now inside. The woman with my face is in the sea, a hot thing. In the beginning I could see her. I could not help her because the clouds were in the way. In the beginning I could see her, the shining in her ears. She does not like the circle around her neck. I know this. I look hard at her so she will know that the clouds are in the way. I am sure she saw me. I am looking at her see me. She empties out her eyes. I am there in the place where her face is, telling her the noisy clouds are in my way. She wants her earrings. She wants her round basket. I want her face, a hot thing. In the beginning, the women are away from the men, and the men are away from the women. Storms rock us and mix the men into the women and the women into the men. That is when I begin to be on the back of the man. For a long time, I see only his neck, his wide shoulders above me. I am small. I love him because he has a song. When he turned around to die, I see the teeth he sang through. His singing was soft. His singing is of the place where a woman takes flowers away from their leaves and puts them in a round basket. Before the clouds, she is crouching near to us. But I do not see her until he locks his eyes and dies on my face. We are that way. There is no breath coming from his mouth, and the place where breath should be is sweet-smelling. The others do not know he is dead. I know. His song is gone. Now I love his pretty little teeth instead. I cannot lose her again. My dead man was in the way like the noisy clouds. When he dies on my face, I can see hers. She is going to smile at me. She is going to. Her sharp earrings are gone. The men without skin are making loud noises. They push my own man through. They do not push the woman with my face through. She goes in. They do not push her. She goes in. The little hill is gone. She was going to smile at me. She was going to. A hot thing. I'm standing in the rainfall. So this is a beautiful poem that goes where they all join. Yeah. So there's one more part I wanted to read because it's the ending. There is a loneliness that can be rocked. Arms crossed, knees drawn up, holding on. This motion, unlike a ship's, smooths and contains the rocker. It's an inside kind, wrapped tight like skin. Then there is a loneliness that roams. No rocking can hold it down. It is alive on its own, a dry and spreading thing that makes the sound of one's own feet going seem to come from a far-off place. Everybody knows what she was called, but no one knew her name. Disremembered and unaccounted for, she cannot be lost because no one is looking for her. And even if they were, how can they call her if they don't know her name? Although she has claim, she is not claimed. In the place where long grass opens, the girl who waited to be loved and cry, shame erupts into her separate parts to make it easy for the chewing laughter to swallow her all away. It was not a story to pass on. They forgot her like a bad dream. After they made up their tales, shaped and decorated them, those that saw her that day on the porch quickly and deliberately forgot her. It took longer for those who had spoken to her, lived with her, fallen in love with her, to forget, until they realized they couldn't remember or repeat a single thing she said and began to believe that other than what they say themselves were, and what they themselves were thinking, she hadn't said anything at all. So in the end, they forgot her too. Remembering seemed unwise. They never knew where or why she crouched, or whose was the underwater face she needed like that, where the memory of the smile under her chin might have been and was not, a latch latched and lichen attached its apple-green bloom to the metal. What made her think her fingernails could open locks the rain rained on? It was not a story to pass on. So they forgot her, like an unpleasant dream during a troubling sleep. Occasionally, however, the rustle of a skirt hushes when they wake, and the knuckles brushing a cheek in sleep seem to belong to the sleeper. Sometimes the photograph of a close friend or relative, looked at too long, shifts, and something more familiar than the dear face itself moves there. They can touch it if they like, but don't, because they know things will never be the same if they do. This is not a story to pass on. Down by the stream and back of 124, her footprints come and go. Come and go. They are so familiar. Should a child, an adult, place his feet in them, they will fit. Take them out and they disappear again as though nobody ever walked there. By and by, all trace is gone, and what is forgotten is not only the footprints, but the water too, and what it is down there. The rest is weather. Not the breath of the disremembered unaccounted for, but wind in the eaves or spring ice thawing too quickly. Just weather. Certainly no clamor for a kiss. Beloved.
Okay. When I finally walked outside...
The primal form.
I had no idea where I was.
Of aggregate volition shining...
Orange lights burning like sunspikes.
As the green light of all performing wisdom.
We are...
Dazzling green, transparent.
Initiating weird riots in my head.
Clear floating on the water.
Glorious and terrifying, beautiful. With orbs surrounded by satellite orbs of radiance.
While in the ink beyond a chorus of coyotes howled.
They break up the little hill and push it through.
Issuing from heart of the divine.
Or was that the traffic?
I cannot find my pretty teeth.
Father, mother.
And no sense of time either.
See the dark face that is going to smile at me.
Green in color.
Stumble together to a corner.
We'll strike against
it. And
that's
it. When the car pulled over.
Thy heart.
A white car.
That
VW Rabbit.
Seriously.
Maybe, maybe not.
Be able to look at it.
I strained to see what this was all about.
Here it's not.
Smile at me.
My Australian gal giggling.
The iron circle.
Both Pac-Man going crazy.
Thereupon through.
She lived right around here somewhere, but wasn't that funny.
Jealousy.
She couldn't remember exactly where.
Thou wilt be terrified.
And me not caring.
Sharp earrings.
Just squinting.
Radiance of green light.
Four round basket.
Intellect to rest in resignation.
She goes in the water.
Or else think it is the hook rays of light of grace.
17 pages missing.
With my face.
That is the karmic path.
Except this stanza does not remain entirely empty.
If thou art attractive to it.
I am standing in the rain falling.
Trust in the dazzling green radiance.
Eternally yours, mommy.
The others are taken.
Connections may be.
Everything falls apart.
I am not taken.
Face so often.
Maybe he was right. Fly from the path.
I am falling like the rain is.
Wisdom may be led backwards.
2 pages missing.
I watch him eat.
The hook rays of light of grace may be able to catch hold of one.
Except this stanza does not remain entirely empty.
Inside, I am crouching to keep from falling with the rain.
At the same time, the light proceeds from the 6 logos will likewise come to shine upon one simultaneously.
Heart blistering with love, mommy.
Oh, nobly born.
Love,
I am
mom.
Going to be in pieces.
Whatever fearful and terrifying visions. Peaceful deities will shine forth in the shape of wrathful deities.
Lude was such a jerk and a shitty fuck, you can tell him that.
He hurts where I sleep.
Although practicing religion, if one obtaineth not Buddhahood,
white.
He puts his finger there.
If one's thought forms be not recognized, as one dieth the shapes of himself.
Except this stanza does not remain entirely empty.
I drop the food and break into pieces.
For that time there is profound teaching.
Moments before the wind.
As above explained.
She took my face away.
It to be born as a male.
With interminable love and devotions, mommy.
Attraction towards the mother and repulsion towards the father.
There is no one to want me.
And if to be born as a female.
To say my name.
Attraction towards the father.
though I still have their drawings.
And repulsion towards the mother.
I wait on the bridge because she is under it.
Together with a feeling of jealousy.
Harold Bloom, critic.
For one of the other which ariseth with will dawn upon thee.
There is night and there is day.
Rising higher and higher and higher until...
O nobly born, when the attraction and repulsion arise, meditate as follows.
Again, again, night, day, I am waiting.
Had I meant to say something memorializing.
Alas, what a being of evil karma am I.
No iron circle is around my neck.
If I still go on feeling attraction and repulsion, then I shall wander in endless samsara.
Blue walls.
No boats go on the water.
Hold thy mind one pointedly upon that resolution. That was me at the end, kind of jazzy.
Perfect.
Wow.
That was fun. That was good. Okay, I'm going to read a story, and I'll preface it thusly. When I was a young person, I was a great fan of the writer J.D. Salinger, who wrote The Catcher in the Rye, among other works. Salinger died in January of last year.
Yeah, that's right.
He was 90-something. He was 91. And he hadn't published since 1965, purposefully. He withdrew from publishing commercial. And... Well, he became a recluse in the sense that he stopped publishing and he withdrew from that world. But I mean, he still had friends. He still socialized. He was from New York City originally. Yeah,
he stopped writing.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. He lived in Cornish, New Hampshire.
Try to hunt him down?
Yeah, they were always trying to hunt him down, and the locals. Cornish is a little town like most towns in northern New England, and once they take a liking to you as a local, they'll protect you from the outsiders, or tend to be idiots. Not all, but most of them tend to be idiots, and so... anyway, he died, lived a long life, died at 91, and okay, so this is the part of the meme where I explain this, where I explain the postcard and everything. I had decided I was going to write something honoring him, because he meant an awful lot to me, and I decided that what I would do, what I had to do was I had to reread his work. He only has 4 books.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So I decided I had to reread them to really remind myself of, personally what he meant to me, and I also wanted to read his work to be just reminded of it, separate from my relation to it. And so, a couple months ago, I started reading his work toward writing a memorial. And I'm going to read the story first before my memorial because it's a really wonderful story, and I think it encapsulates everything that's good about him. If you just read one story of his and you read this one, you would get, it's like if you heard one of the best songs of somebody. If you heard Neil Young's Like a Hurricane or something, you could say, okay, I haven't heard everything, but I've heard him at a good beat. So... this is a story called For Esme with Love and Squalor, and I think in some ways, I think in more ways than one, it's a true story. In more ways than one. So, For Esme with Love and Squalor. Just recently, by airmail, I received an invitation to a wedding that will take place in England on April 18th. It happens to be a wedding I'd give a lot to be able to get to, and when the invitation I first arrived, I thought it might be possible for me to make the trip abroad by plane, expenses be hanged. However, I've since discussed the matter rather extensively with my wife, a breathtakingly level-headed girl, and we've decided against it. For one thing, I've completely forgotten that my mother-in-law is looking forward to spending the last 2 weeks in April with us. I don't really get to see Mother Grencher terribly often, and she's not getting any younger. She's 58, as she'd be the first to admit. All the same, though, wherever I happen to be, I don't think I'm the type that doesn't even lift a finger to prevent a wedding from flatting. Accordingly, I've gone ahead and jotted down a few revealing notes on the bride, as I knew her almost 6 years ago. If my notes should cause the groom, whom I haven't met, an uneasy moment or two, so much the better. Nobody's aiming to please here, more really to edify, to instruct. In April of 1944, I was among 60 American enlisted men who took a rather specialized pre-invasion training course directed by British intelligence in Devon, England. And as I look back, it seemed to me that we were fairly unique, the 60 of us, in that there wasn't one good mixer in the bunch. We were all essentially letter-writing types, and when we spoke to each other out of line of duty, it was usually to ask somebody if he had any ink he wasn't using. When we weren't writing letters or attending classes, each of us went pretty much his own way. Mine usually led me on clear days in scenic circles around the countryside. Rainy days, I generally sat in a dry place and read a book, often just an axe length away from a ping-pong table. The training course lasted 3 weeks, ending on a Saturday, a very rainy one. At 7 that last night, our whole group was scheduled to entrain for London, where, as rumor had it, we were to be assigned to infantry and airborne divisions mustered for the D-Day landings. By 3 in the afternoon, I'd packed all my belongings in my barrack bag, including a canvas gas mask container full of books I brought over from the other side. The gas mask itself I'd slipped through a porthole of the Mauritania some weeks earlier, fully aware that if the enemy ever did use gas, I'd never get the damn thing on in time. I remember standing at an end window of our Quonset hut for a long time, looking out at the slanting, dreary rain, my trigger finger itching imperceptibly, if at all. I could hear behind my back the uncomradely scratching of many fountain pens on many sheets of V-mail paper. Abruptly, with nothing special in mind, I came away from the window and put on my raincoat, cashmere muffler, galoshes, woolen gloves, and overseas cap, the last of which I'm still told I wear at an angle all my own, slightly down over both ears. Then, after synchronizing my wristwatch with the clock in the latrine, I walked down the long, wet cobblestone hill into town. I ignored the flashes of lightning all around me. They either had your number on them or they didn't. In the center of town, which was probably the wettest part of town, I stopped in front of a church to read the bulletin board, mostly because the featured numerals, white on black, had caught my attention, but partly because after 3 years in the Army, I'd become addicted to reading bulletin boards. At 3:15, the board stated there would be children's choir practice. I looked at my wristwatch, then back at the board. A sheet of paper was tacked up, listing the names of the children expected to attend practice. I stood in the rain and read all the names, then entered the church. A dozen or so adults were among the pews, several of them bearing pairs of small-sized rubbers, soles up, in their laps. I passed along and sat down in the front row. On the rostrum, seated in three compact rows of auditorium chairs, were about 20 children, mostly girls, ranging in age from about 7 to 13. At the moment, their choir coach, an enormous woman in tweeds, was advising them to open their mouths wider when they sang. Had anyone, she asked, ever heard of a little dicky bird that dared to sing his charming song without first opening his little beak wide, wide, wide? Apparently nobody ever had. She was given a steady, opaque look. She went on to say that she wanted all her children to absorb the meaning of the words they sang, not just mouth them like silly billy parrots. She then blew a note on her pitch pipe, and the children, like so many underage weightlifters, raised their hymn books. They sang without instrumental accompaniment, or more accurately in their case, without any interference. Their voices were melodious and unsentimental, almost to the point where a somewhat more denominational man than myself might, without straining, have experienced levitation. A couple of the very youngest children dragged the tempo a trifle, but in a way that only the composer's mother could have found fault with. I have never heard the hymn, but I kept hoping it was one with a dozen or more verses. Listening, I scanned all the children's faces, but watched one in particular, that of the child nearest me on the end seat in the front row. She was about 13, with straight ash blonde hair of ear lobe length, an exquisite forehead and blasé eyes that I thought might very possibly have counted the house. Her voice was distinctly separate from the other children's voices, and not just because she was seated near me. It had the best upper register, the sweetest sounding, the surest, and it automatically led the way. The young lady, however, seemed slightly bored with her own singing ability, or perhaps just with the time and place. Twice between verses, I saw her yawn. It was a ladylike yawn, a closed-mouthed yawn, but you couldn't miss it. Her nostril wings gave her away. The instant the hymn ended, the choir coach began to give her lengthy opinion of people who can't keep their feet still and their lips sealed tight during the minister's sermon. I gathered that the singing part of the rehearsal was over, and before the coach's dissonant speaking voice could entirely break the spell the children singing had cast, I got up and left the church. It was raining even harder. I walked down the street and looked through the window of the Red Cross recreation room, but soldiers were standing 2 and 3 deep at the coffee counter, and even through the glass I could hear ping-pong balls bouncing in another room. I crossed the street and entered a civilian tea room, which was empty except for a middle-aged waitress who looked as if she would have preferred a customer with a dry raincoat. I used a coat tree as delicately as possible and then sat down at a table and ordered tea and cinnamon toast. It was the first time all day I'd spoken to anyone. I then looked through all my pockets, including my raincoat, and finally found a couple of stale letters to reread, one from my wife telling me how the service at Schraff's 88th Street had fallen off, and one from my mother-in-law asking me to please send her some cashmere yarn, first time I got away from camp. While I was still in my first cup of tea, the young lady I'd been watching and listening to in the choir came into the tea room. Her hair was soaking wet and the rims of both ears were showing. She was with a very small boy, unmistakably her brother, whose cap she removed by lifting it off his head with 2 fingers as if it were a laboratory specimen. Bringing up the rear was an efficient-looking woman in a limp felt hat, presumably their governess. The choir member, taking off her coat as she walked across the floor, made the table selection, a good one from my point of view, as it was just 8 or 10 feet directly in front of me. She and the governess sat down. The small boy, who was about 5, wasn't ready to sit down yet. He slid out of and discarded his reefer. Then, with the deadpan expression of a born heller, he methodically went about annoying his governess by pushing in and pulling out his chair several times, watching her face. The governess, keeping her voice down, gave him 2 or 3 orders to sit down and, in effect, stop the monkey business, but it was only when his sister spoke to him that he came around and applied the small of his back to his jersey. He immediately picked up his napkin and put it on his head. His sister removed it, opened it, and spread it on his lap. About the time their tea was brought, the choir member caught me staring over at her party. She stared back at me with those house-counting eyes of hers, then abruptly gave me a small, qualified smile. It was oddly radiant, as certain small, qualified smiles sometimes are. I smiled back, much less radiantly, keeping my upper lip down over a coal-black GI temporary filling showing between 2 of my front teeth. The next thing I knew, the young lady was standing with enviable poise beside my table. She was wearing a tartan dress, a Campbell tartan, I believe. It seemed to me to be a wonderful dress for a very young girl to be wearing on a rainy, rainy day. "I thought Americans despised tea," she said. It wasn't the observation of a smart aleck, but that of a truth lover or a statistics lover. I replied that some of us never drank anything but tea. I'd asked her if she cared to join me. "Thank you," she said, perhaps for just a fraction of a moment. I got up and drew a chair for her, the one opposite me, and she sat down on the forward quarter of it, keeping her spine easily and beautifully straight. I went back, almost hurried back, to my own chair, more than willing to hold up my end of a conversation. When I was seated, I couldn't think of anything to say, though. I smiled, still keeping my coal-black filling under concealment. I remarked it certainly was a terrible day out. "Yes, quite," said my guest in the clear, unmistakable voice of a small-talk detester. She placed her fingers flat on the table edge like someone at a seance, then almost instantly closed her hands. Her nails were bitten down to the quick. She was wearing a wristwatch, a military-looking one that looked rather like a navigator's chronograph. Its face was much too large for her slender wrist. "You were at choir practice," she said matter-of-factly. "I saw you." I said I certainly had been, and that I heard her singing separately from the others. I said I thought she had a very fine voice. She nodded. "I know. I'm going to be a professional singer." "Really? Opera?" "Heavens, no. I'm going to sing jazz on the radio and make heaps of money. Then, when I'm 30, I shall retire and live on a ranch in Ohio." She touched the top of her soaking wet head with the flat of her hand. "Do you know Ohio?" she asked. I said I'd been through it a few times in the train, but I really didn't know it. I offered her a piece of cinnamon toast. "No, thank you," she said. "I eat like a bird, actually." I bit into a piece of toast myself and commented that there was some mighty rough country around Ohio. "I know. An American I met told me. You're the 11th American I've met." Her governess was now urgently signaling her to return to her own table, in effect to stop bothering the man. My guest, however, calmly moved her chair 1 or 2 inches so that her back broke all possible further communication with the home table. "You go to that secret intelligence school in the hill, don't you?" she inquired coolly. As security-minded as the next one, I replied I was visiting Devonshire for my health. "Really," she said, "I wasn't quite born yesterday, you know." I said I bet she hadn't been at that. I drank my tea for a moment. I was getting a trifle posture conscious, and I sat up somewhat straighter in my seat. "You seem quite intelligent for an American," my guest mused. I told her that was a pretty snobbish thing to say if you thought about it at all, and that I hoped it was unworthy of her. She blushed, automatically conferring on me the social poise I'd been missing. "Well, most of the Americans I've seen act like animals. They're forever punching one another about and insulting everyone, and you know what one of them did?" I shook my head. "One of them threw an empty whiskey bottle through my aunt's window. Fortunately, the window was open, but does that sound very intelligent to you?" It didn't especially, but I didn't say so. I said that many soldiers all over the world were a long way from home, and that many of them had had, and that few of them had had many real advantages in life. I said I thought that most people could figure out that for themselves. "Possibly," said my guest without conviction. She raised her hand to her wet head again, picked at a few limp filaments of blonde hair, trying to cover her exposed ear rims. "My hair is soaking wet," she said. "I look a fright." She looked over at me. "I have quite wavy hair when it's dry." "I can see that. I can see that you have. Not actually curly, but quite wavy," she said. "Are you married?" I said I was. She nodded. "Are you deeply in love with your wife, or am I being too personal?" I said that when she was, I'd speak up. She put her hands and wrists further forward on the table, and I remember wanting to do something about that enormous face rich watch she was wearing, perhaps suggest that she try wearing it around her waist. "Usually I'm not terribly gregarious," she said, and looked over at me to see if I knew the meaning of the word. I didn't give her a sign, though, one way or the other. "I purely came over here because I thought you looked extremely lonely. You have an extremely sensitive face." I said she was right, that I had been feeling lonely, and that I was very glad she'd come over. "I'm training myself to be more compassionate. My aunt says I'm a terribly cold person," she said, and felt the top of her head again. "I live with my aunt. She's an extremely kind person. Since the death of my mother, she's done everything within her power to make Charles and me feel adjusted. I'm glad. Mother was an extremely intelligent person, quite sensuous in many ways. She looked at me with a kind of fresh acuteness. Do you find me terribly cold?" I told her absolutely not, very much to the contrary, in fact. I told her my name and asked for hers. She hesitated. "My first name is Esme. I don't think I shall tell my full name for the moment. I have a title, and you might just be impressed by titles. Americans are, you know." I said I didn't think I would be, but that might it might be a good idea at that to hold on to the title for a while. Just then, I felt someone's warm breath in the back of my neck. I turned around and just missed brushing noses with Esme's small brother. Ignoring me, he addressed his sister in a piercing treble. "Miss Megley says you must come and finish your tea." His message delivered, he retired to the chair between his sister and me on my right. I regarded him with high interest. He was looking very splendid in brown Shetland shorts, a navy blue jersey, white shirt, and striped necktie. He gazed back at me with immense green eyes. "Why do people in films kiss sideways?" he demanded. "Sideways," I said. It was a problem that had baffled me in my childhood. I said I guessed it was because actors' noses are too big for kissing anyone head-on. "His name is Charles," Esme said. "He's extremely brilliant for his age." "He certainly has green eyes, haven't you, Charles?" Charles gave me the fishy look my question deserved, then wriggled downward and forward in his chair till all of his body was under the table except his head, which he left, wrestler's bridge style, on the chair seat. "They're orange," he said in a strained voice, addressing the ceiling. He picked up a corner of the tablecloth and put it over his handsome, deadpan little face. "Sometimes he's brilliant and sometimes he's not," Esme said. "Charles, do sit up." Charles stayed right where he was. He seemed to be holding his breath. "He misses our father very much. He was S-L-A-I-N in North Africa. I express regret to hear it." Esme nodded. "Father adored him." She bit reflectively at a cuticle of her thumb. "He looks very much like my mother. Charles, I mean. I look exactly like my father." She went on biting at her cuticle. "My mother was quite a passionate woman. She was an extrovert. Father was an introvert. They were quite well mated, though, in a superficial way. To be quite candid, father really needed more an intellectual companion than mother was. He was an extremely gifted genius." I waited receptively for further information, but none came. I looked down at Charles, who was now resting the side of his face on his chair seat. When he saw that I was looking at him, he closed his eyes sleepily, angelically, then stuck out his tongue, an appendage of startling length, and gave what in my country would have been a glorious tribute to a myopic baseball umpire. It fairly shook the tea room. "Stop that," Esme said, clearly unshaken. "He saw an American do it in a fish and chips queue, and now he does it whenever he's bored. Just stop it now, or I shall send you directly to Miss Megley." Charles opened his enormous eyes, as sign that he'd heard his sister's threat, but otherwise didn't look especially alerted. He closed his eyes again and continued to rest the side of his face on the chair seat. I mentioned that maybe you ought to save it, meaning the Bronx Cheer, till he started using his title regularly. That is, if he had a title, too. Esme gave me a long, faintly clinical look. You have a dry sense of humor, haven't you? She said, wistfully. Father said I have no sense of humor at all. He said I was unequipped to meet life because I have no sense of humor. Watching her, I lit a cigarette and said I didn't think a sense of humor was of any use in a real pinch. Father said it was. This was a statement of faith, not a contradiction, and I quickly switched horses. I nodded and said her father had probably taken the long view while I was taking the short, whatever that meant. Charles misses him exceedingly, Esme said after a moment. He was an exceedingly lovable man. He was extremely handsome, too. Not that one's appearance matters greatly, but he was. He had terribly penetrating eyes for a man who was intrinsically kind. I nodded. I said I imagined her father had had an extraordinary vocabulary. Oh, yes, quite, said Esme. He was an archivist. Amateur, of course. At that point, I felt an importune tap, almost a punch, on my upper arm from Charles's direction. I turned to him. He was sitting in a fairly normal position in his chair now, except that he had one knee tucked under him. What did one wall say to the other? He asked shrilly. It's a riddle. I rolled my eyes reflectively ceilingward and repeated the question aloud. Then I looked at Charles with a stumped expression and I said I gave up. Meet you at the corner, came the punchline at top volume. It went over biggest with Charles himself. It struck him as unbearably funny. In fact, Esme had to come around and pound him on the back as if treating him for a coughing spell. Now stop that, she said. She went back to her own seat. He tells that same riddle to everyone he meets and has a fit every single time. Usually he drools when he laughs. Now just stop, please. It's one of the best riddles I've heard, though, I said, watching Charles, who was very gradually coming out of it. In response to this compliment, he sank considerably lower in his chair and again masked his face up to the eyes with a corner of the tablecloth. He then looked at me with his exposed eyes, which were full of slowly subsiding mirth and the pride of someone who knows a really good riddle or two. May I inquire how you were employed before entering the army? Esme asked me. I said I hadn't been employed at all, that I'd been out of college a year, but that I'd like to think of myself as a professional short story writer. She nodded politely. Published? She asked. It was a familiar but always touchy question, and one that I didn't answer just 1, 2, 3. I started to explain how most editors in America were a bunch. My father wrote beautifully, Esme interrupted. I'm saving a number of his letters for posterity. I said that sounded like a very good idea. I happened to be looking at her enormous-faced chronographic wristwatch again. I asked if it belonged to her father. She looked down at her wrist solemnly. Yes, it did, she said. He gave it to me just before Charles and I were evacuated. Self-consciously, she took her hands off the table, saying, purely as a memento, of course. She guided the conversation in a different direction. I'd be extremely flattered if you'd write a story exclusively for me sometime. I'm an avid reader. I told her I certainly would, if I could. I said I wasn't terribly prolific. It doesn't have to be terribly prolific, just so that it isn't childish and silly. My favorite line. She reflected, I prefer stories about squalor. About what? I said, leaning forward. Squalor. I'm extremely interested in squalor. I was about to press her for more details, but I felt Charles pinching me hard on my arm. I turned to him, wincing slightly. He was standing right next to me. What did one wall say to the other wall? He asked, not unfamiliarly. You asked him that, Esme said. Now stop it. Ignoring his sister and stepping up on one of his feet, Charles repeated the key question. I noticed that his necktie knot wasn't adjusted properly. I slid it up into place, then, looking him straight in the eye, suggested, meet you at the corner? The instant I'd said it, I wished I hadn't. Charles's mouth fell open. I felt as if I'd struck it open myself. He stepped down off my foot and, with white-hot dignity, walked over to his own table without looking back. He's furious, Esme said. He has a violent temper. My mother had a propensity to spoil him. My father was the only one who didn't spoil him. I kept looking at Charles, who had sat down and started to drink his tea using both hands on the cup. I hope he'd turn around, but he didn't. Esme stood up. Il faut que je parte aussi. I can't speak French. She said, yeah, I think time to leave.
I think you did fine.
Oh, okay. She said with a sigh, do you know French? I got up from my own chair with mixed feelings of regret and confusion. Esme and I shook hands. Her hand, as I suspected, was a nervous hand, damp at the palm. I told her in English how very much I'd enjoyed her company. She nodded. I thought you might, she said. I'm quite communicative for my age. She gave her hair another experimental touch. I'm dreadfully sorry about my hair, she said. I've probably been hideous to look at.
Uh-huh.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of the wave is coming back already. She quickly touched her hair again. Do you think you'll ever be coming back here in the immediate future? She asked. We come here every Saturday after choir practice. I answered that I'd like nothing better than that, but unfortunately I was pretty sure I wouldn't be able to make it again. In other words, you can't discuss troop movements, said Esme. She made no move to leave the vicinity of the table. In fact, she crossed one foot over the other and, looking down, aligned the toes of her shoes. It was a pretty execution, for she was wearing white socks and her ankles and feet were lovely. She looked up at me abruptly. Would you like me to write to you? She asked with a certain amount of color in her face. I write extremely articulate letters for a person my... I'd love it. I took out a pencil and paper and wrote down my rank, name, serial number, and APO number. I shall write to you first, she said, accepting it, so that you don't feel compromised in any way. She put the address in the pocket of her dress. Goodbye, she said, and walked back to her table. I ordered another pot of tea and sat watching the two of them till they and the harassed Miss Megley got up to leave. Charles led the way, limping tragically like a man with one leg several inches shorter than the other. He didn't look over at me. Miss Megley went next, then Esme waved at me. I waved back, half getting up from my chair. It was a strangely emotional moment for me. Less than a minute later, Esme came back into the tea room, dragging Charles behind her by the sleeve of his reefer. Charles would like to kiss you goodbye, she said. I immediately put down my cup and said that was very nice, but was she sure? Yes, she said, a trifle grimly. She let go Charles' sleeve and gave me a rather vigorous push in my direction. He came forward, his face livid, and gave me a loud, wet smacker just below the right ear. Following this ordeal, he started to make a beeline for the door in a less sentimental way of life. But I... but I caught the half belt at the back of his reefer, held on to it, and asked him, what did one wall say to the other? His face lit up. Meet you at the corner, he shrieked and raced out of the room, possibly in hysterics. Esme was standing with crossed ankles again. You're quite sure you won't forget to write that story for me, she said. It doesn't have to be exclusively for me. It can. I said there was absolutely no chance that I'd forget. I told her that I'd never written a story for anybody, but it seemed like exactly the right time to get down to it. She nodded. Make it extremely squalid and moving, I suggested. Are you at all acquainted with squalor? I said not exactly, but that I was getting better acquainted with it all the time, in one form or another all the time, and I'd do my best to come up to her specifications. We shook hands. Isn't it a pity we didn't meet under less extenuating circumstances? I said it was. I said it certainly was. Goodbye, Esme said. I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact. I thanked her and said a few other words and then watched her leave the tea room. She left it slowly, reflectively, testing the ends of her hair for dryness. Epistolary Notes begins with an epigraph, or a quote, actually, from his story Zoe, which reads, an artist's only concern is to shoot for some kind of perfection, and on his terms, not anyone else's. And then I begin. I spent years of my young manhood reading your four books and wondering what you were, how you did what you did on page, how I might too. I chased you as you chased your characters, came to reside among them, indifferent at last to readers and to publishers and to anyone else, frankly. And I kept writing. 'Twas you and Rilke, a scant few others, Dickinson comes to mind, a shadow of Emerson, that nodded me along my way, not a path quite, and still not. I kept an occasional eye on you, up there in Cornish, the famous grumpy recluse, whose sole novel was taught to millions of high school seniors year by year. I'd been one. Read Catcher in the Rye when I was 17 in 1981, nodded at its truth, not so much wondering at how you understood what it was like to be 17, horny and misunderstood, powerless, a cock, a heart, a lot of half-made questions, but wishing you'd say what the fuck to do about it all. At my worst, now I'd say, write a famous novel and live hidden off the royalty checks for decades. But that gets at nothing. less than nothing. You published 3 more books of fiction after Catcher. They showed maturation. They showed garrulous genius. They showed you increasingly didn't give a fuck. That was the lesson, if one at all, if one saw it and chose to grapple with it. Don't give a fuck. Write your heart out, with all your stars out. Aim at perfection by your own terms. Rilke had said as much before you. You echoed him, and were funny, too. So, to interrupt, you died nearly a year ago, and it took till recently for me to confront this. Your passing, you again, dead, and me not 17, and whatever any of this means. I reread Catcher in the Rye first several weeks ago. Jobless, read it by mornings on my couch, in my quiet apartment, my wife gone to work with her smile and kiss. Read it morning by morning, seeing it for what it was, what it wasn't. Seeing it later, no longer 17, no longer shocked by it. But back then, in those early 1950s, boy, were they shocked. Even now it still gets banned in places of terrified fanaticism. Holden Caulfield is a young, smart, horny boy who feels too much and sees no path for him to walk toward understanding. Feels things are wrong in the world. Too many fuck you graffitos on too many walls. Too many scrawny underage prostitutes. Too many impoverished nuns and possibly gay school teachers. Too many people to love who do not love themselves. Too many slobs and phonies. Holden's is the undiscriminating heart trying, unwilling, nearly unable to learn discrimination. He suffers, misses everyone, even the lying bastards and crumbums. Fine, I think now, cruelly, he needs to get laid. Or just blown. Or something. Would he just feel sorry for the girl's serious look as she goes down on him? Or her open-mouthed cry when she comes? Maybe. Probably. I don't know. Or will he get to college and work it out with books and professors and older women met at diners and Greenwich Village jazz clubs? I don't know. I turned to 9 stories and found that I still enjoyed it, but was less moved. In some, you could not fully unload your metaphysical freight on such short trips. Your short masterpiece for Esme with Love and Squalor follows through on its possibilities, but the rest lose steam the moment you hit the epiphany. They fade, climax, roll over, and go to sleep. So I arrived to your final 2 books, each containing 2 novellas, Franny and Zoe, and Race High, the Roof Beams Carpenters, with Seymour in introduction. I reread these 4 pieces last night and tonight swallowed myself whole in them. These half-century-old works. You were alive through Obama's election, well into his current term, yet these are the last published traces of you. Technically, your last published story was Hapworth 16, 1924, but this epic mess of a story, which appeared in the June 1965 issue of The New Yorker, never made it to book form, and it's a poor story. I tried again to reread it recently, faltered, and fell asleep. Maybe I was just tired, or feeling hurried to finish this piece. I preferred to think that this story is the sound of a door slamming on the reading audience. It felt like goodbye. Oddly, I came across a comment you made to the man, Roger Lathbury, who almost published this story in book form in 2000 or thereabouts. He said you called it a high point of your writing. The Glass Family. This is what he wrote about in his last 2 stories. This family of New Yorkers. I wonder how many pages you wrote unpublished about them these past decades. Maybe it will sooner or later be known, the rumored manuscripts brought to life, given to the world. Maybe. But I didn't read these volumes for that reason. I read them to resurrect you in my mind, alive, living in New England also, yet a ghost, an artist who'd found his peace in ceasing to publish his works, who believed, like Rilke, like Dickinson, for different reasons perhaps, that not the audience but the act was paramount, how it feels to do, not how it feels to gain response. So I read these books closer upon each other than I'd ever done before back when, and I saw you disappearing into your work. You became a member of your own fictional family. Not Jerome David Salinger, but Buddy Glass. Seems Buddy had written the works published under Salinger's name. A sort of game, a sort of joke, but no, not really. Not at all. You'd lucked out writing a perennial bestseller you were opting to get while the getting out was still pretty good. Even back in the 50s, the mass audience wanted sequels, not works increasingly difficult to read without complete surrender. The next section begins with this passage from Seymour in introduction. I say that the true artist seer, the heavenly fool who can and does produce beauty, is mainly dazzled to death by his own scruples, the blinding shapes and colors of his own sacred human conscience. Back in college, I wrote numerous papers on your stories. I worked them over, in truth, more for my own purposes than anything else. The literature classes and their grades simply gave me good cover. I witnessed in my reading time and again, and in these recent days as well, that you were taking an increasingly strange path in writing about the Large Glass family, their roots in vaudeville and radio and television, their obsession with Eastern thought, the nature of art, and each other. The Glass Family stories reflected your obsession with them. It was as though you'd finally gathered together everything, at least that what mattered to you, a family of genius artists, New Yorkers, whose lives were funny, tragic, odd, and at moments even humanly mundane. But, and I keep running into this, writing about them seemed to clash with publishing these stories. Clash and was also unnecessary. Catcher and the other books purchased you comfortable seclusion in Cornish, New Hampshire, where the townspeople took to you as a friendly transplant who liked his privacy. Your books may not have interested many of them, but they all understood your wish for privacy. Thus the mysteries remain. Where you took your fictional family, how life after publishing affected your art. All I can do is say the following and marvel. From 1965 to 2010, nearly half a century, you wrote unknown numbers of pages. I tend to think at least hundreds, maybe thousands. And my strange turn of mind wonders what your last work was like. What when you were in your 80s, I've seen the world change and change and change again. And then the penultimate section is begins with a passage from Catcher in the Rye. You can't ever find a place that's nice and peaceful because there isn't any. You may think there is, but once you get there, when you're not looking, somebody will sneak up and write fuck you right under your name, right under your nose. Try it sometime. I think even if I die and they stick me in a cemetery, and I have a tombstone and all, it'll say Holden Caulfield on it, and then what year I was born and what year I died, and then right under that it'll say fuck you. I'm positive, in fact. It was some years ago my friend M and I drove up to Cornish to look around. A pretty little New England town on the Connecticut River, covered bridge to Windsor and Vermont, explained the P.O. box that I read somewhere was yours being in Windsor, not Cornish. A county fairgrounds, home to the annual Cornish Fair in August. I'm glad to have looked around that day, even if it really drew me little nearer to you. In a way less famous and lucrative than you did, I've nonetheless walked a not dissimilar path to yours. I gave up publishing in others' periodicals after rejection letters many years ago. It seemed like too much work and too discouraging. There was no internet back then to find encouragement. It was New York or nothing. Eventually, I took my youthful but abandoned notions of my own press, scripter press, and made them real. I now publish and distribute how I wish, underground, not for profit, in a variety of mediums even. My obsessions in art have become my own after 3 decades of work. We share generally the twined themes of empathy and kindness, the struggle of one soul to breach the gap to another, to touch another, but you returning again and again to Eastern and Christian literature for a kind of intellectual grounding is not one that I pursue. Similarly, I don't think your story is probably ever drenched in the kind of unitary psychedelic vision I work through over and over again. Movies and TV shows and bunnies and beagles and forests and hotels do not affect your work with the sentient potency they do mine. But I wouldn't have got to where I am if I hadn't read your books to learn how you did it back then. And lastly, final section, Jim, begins with a familiar epigraph. You take a really sleepy man, Esme, and he always stands a chance of becoming a man with his fact, with his F-A-C-U-L-T-I-E-S intact. I'd like to think whatever else you were in life, the part of you that made it to the page and was published in books was some of your best. For it is on the written page that I know you best, not in photos or anecdotal accounts of your friends or family or even in biographies. I'd like to think that the marble and mud of your life is distilled to the 4 books you published, that in their pages you asked your best questions, offered up your best answers, your hopes, your fears, and so on. I think this because it seems to be reasonably true and because I do the same thing. Much of my best arrives on the page, and some of my worst, and a lot else too. And if there were no more stories to come from you post-mortem, if you simply never wrote any or burned them all at some point, I'd like to think that this is okay. I don't know this for sure, but it's a hope. I admit a greater hope is a big cachet of stories due in book form on a near timeline. But whatever else I do or do not know, or do not know how to know for sure, this. You were a brilliant writer, affected and still affect my life. And like long-dead Seymour's effect on his fictional family, of which you took your own part, you yourself live on ever profoundly large, continually forming and reforming in my heart and head. You have my deepest gratitude and affection. Rest in peace, brother.
Excellent. Nice, yeah. Nice. Yeah. She used to work in diner. Never saw a woman look finer. I used to order just to watch her float across the floor. She grew up in a small town, never put her roots down. Her daddy kept moving, so she did too. Somewhere on a desert highway, she rides a Harley Davidson. Thank you.
fish.
Days ago, I said, "Hey, I'm having this gathering. I want to have you present in one form or another." He said, "Okay." First thing came off the top of his head was something called A Thanksgiving Prayer by William S. Burroughs. And it's very typically this guy, this Burroughs guy. He wrote Naked Lunch. He's a fellow who, once you've seen him, you won't forget him.
For John Dillinger, in hope, he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and passenger pigeons destined to be shit out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream to vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK for nigger killing lawmen feeding their notches. For decent church-going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for Kill a Queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for laboratory AIDS. Thanks for prohibition and the war against drugs. Thanks for a country where nobody is allowed to mind his own business. Thanks for a nation of finks. Yes, thanks for all the memories. All right, let's see your arms. You always were a headache, and you always were a bore. Thanks for the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams.
Her poems are pretty intense, but then when you hear her read, it's like a whole new level of intensity.
Yeah, that's true.
So I asked her for the poem she's going to read. I asked her to publish it this time because it's a pretty intense poem, and then I asked her for a video of it, and she had one on hand. So.
Bad manners. I don't know who to be angry with anymore. That's a lie. I do know. But my rage can't find a release tunnel, something or somewhere to race through. I need to see someone with real power apply a tourniquet to the hemorrhaging of the mortally wounded countries my country has stabbed. It is not enough to see the burning bodies on the news in high definition. You must know that our backyard barbecues mask the smell of smoke across the planet. It is not enough to know that in my country there are mothers in jail for protesting the deaths of their children who were forced to kill other children in other countries, children who were told to kill them. Knowing is nothing. Fury is nothing. Oh, sweet America, I don't crave forgiveness for not singing I Love Barney songs with your babies when I know that the scent of Quinta and the taste of Kubos have been stripped away from the noses and mouths of those you helped to destroy. I'm not some remorseful woman in a shopping mall unable to grasp the notion of what belongs to who. We belong to we. The windows through which we watch the world are cleaner than our hands, and the ghosts fleeing by those windows no longer care what languages they speak. Talking of how the water of the rivers in Liberia became beds of gravel, and the hills of Sarajevo were too gouged and flattened for snow play, a poet said to me, "All you can do is write it again and again until honor turns some of this around." There's a chance he was right, and there's a chance that it's bullshit and can't be turned around. So here is that place in the poem where my rage and futility has made me teary and sad. Listen, please. It is not indigestion keeping you awake nights, or the thoughts of a heart you broke in some fit of bad manners or microwaved lust. No. This insomnia you suffer is made of oil and blood blending. This insomnia is the total absence of love as humans have known it. This is unabashed knowing climbing into bed with you, putting its hands around your throat and squeezing until your heart bursts open and its pieces scatter over the world like petals.
Our friend Jude reading six of her poems.
Hi everyone at the Jellicoe meeting. This is Judy speaking from Kibbutz near Oz in the western Negev. And we're in the middle of a sandstorm, and it's not a good idea to go outside now. So I'll just stay in, and I'll do for you some of the poems that are in the latest Seneca 76. So I hope you like them, and here it goes. The first one is called Who Will Know When I Die? And this is something I wrote while sitting in this very room, looking out my window and watching life go by. Okay, so here it goes. Who will know when I die? I'll be sitting in my study, writing haiku. Who will know when I die? Kibbutz gardeners shuffling outside my window, intent on finding stray pecans. Who will know when I die? Birds will fly through breezes, every hour a different song. Who will know when I die? No one will call or come for a visit, each alone in their daily grind. Who will know when I die? My dusty corpse will feed the flies, my computer's poem barely formed. Who will know when I die? Okay, and now some haiku. The flux of the days. Some search, some sit back and ponder. Reality takes time. Long papyrus centuries unroll in holy sutra. A slow trek, a bird and I, this November morn. Forests ablaze, friends evacuate homes, cameras on watch. So happy to sleep, happier to wake. Life is good. Okay, that's enough for me. Enjoy your evening, and happy holidays to everybody. Bye.
Mine's called Houseplants.
There you go.
It's a continuation of your novel. Pieces.
It is.
Yeah.
Another piece of the novel. Everything in our house now is crazy bright feeling. Max has everything bending and twirling. Plants are growing at odd angles and taking flight. There was a frighteningly gangly plant of unknown genus and species that keeps reaching for the ceiling, shooting out parasol leaf clusters aiming upward. It started out 3 inches tall and is now 6 feet tall in the corner of our living room, overwhelming the tiny Christmas shop unfinished plant table it rests on. When it hits the ground, no longer fitting for a table, it will take over more and more, growing upward until it knocks a hole in the ceiling and plunges up through our bedroom, then through the loft and out into the sky. A potted snapdragon wings out at an angle never seen out of doors. The jade is sprawling. D.H. Lawrence-style columbine seed pods are rising erect from the once placid purple coleus. Everything seems to be reaching. And us, we are tentative, as if we can't imagine how to wind and grow like these plants. And yet we are. It feels uneven, as though the ground might give out and leave us floating. Houseplants.
I think you should read the third and final one. Okay. Yeah, they're all
this
really good.
This one's called Skies. The millennium shift has been eating away at me, transforming the earth underfoot. I have been dizzy more and more until I can rarely spend a whole day without swaying or falling in the direction dictated by gravitational storm. If there were any doubt or need for external validation of these changes on the planet, which are so personally kinesthetically real, the sky would clinch it. Since right before 2000, 1999 to be exact, instead of one sky, there has been an eruption on a daily basis of several skies, not in sequence, but at once. In one single sky, there will be cirrus clouds, nimbus clouds, stratus clouds, and cumulus clouds. They will ride in layers or cordon off different parts of the same sky and ride toward each other. They will lie at different levels and shift through each other like outstretched fingers, slowly or at a pace. One set will cast long shadows over the earth, while less presumptuous clouds will just puff along with grayish rings, or tinges, sorry. One day last week, I witnessed several blimp-like clouds in the process of overtaking a broad sweep of winged angel clouds. The backdrop was a yellowish-white in the southern, western, and eastern quadrants, while the northern quadrant was breaking through with blue. A low, overbearing cloud nosed along from the south, looming close over office buildings, proclaiming itself intruding. A giant, it presided over earth and sky with broad personality, nipping at smaller clouds, frightening seagulls, shadowing the streets. I drove away as its menace set upon the city. I wondered whether I would find the city the same the next day. Of course, the city is never the same twice. It's a moving, thrashing set of energies, hemmed by growing and crumbling structures. But I wondered whether it would be there in the same ways it had been, allowing the usual room for variation. And the city was still there the next day, perhaps just a bit more gray and churning. And the overarching sky, completely untroubled by memory, produces the next set of multiple skies, complex, majestic, apocalyptic, without regard for what came before. The fundamentalists and mystics talk about the last days coming, and I have to wonder, have we missed them? If I sway and fall to a wild and unfamiliar gravitational pull, if we admire double and triple, quadruple rainbows across a fraction sky, are we in a time of something we don't know, can't fathom? We find our way haltingly, divorced from the earth and sky we knew before. Could it be so different? I look down at my feet and keep moving.
Those are really good.
And it begins with a quote called, which reads, "Beauty is sexual." That's the first thing that is in that section. And that's from Ezra Pound. He wrote that somewhere. So. All right, here we go. "Beauty is sexual, as though one could define or equal the other, yet it's been said many times, now wreck it on this bathroom wall, written carefully in a ragged space between the cocks and the cunts and the assholes and the whores' phone numbers, and in two colors, no less. Black letters and red outlines, the red ink from a leaky pen so splotches, yet give a closer look to see to how like blood these splotches are, how like declarative violence, how like it, and a chance moment it's dusk, and the high window above this single pisser scatters light through the cement room, and some kind of refracting sheen hits this spot, these words, and the whole thing pulses. Fuck if I know what is like this carefully marked confession. What else can it be? It pulses now. And is that the uneven soft cement, or how it is lacquered, or maybe stray splashes of piss wet and the drying and again and the light and the two colors of ink and the cocks and the cunts and the assholes that surround it. What the fuck? When something so casual begins to feel like more than confession, more than instructions, a more desperate man might call it revelation and try to figure it out and follow it along. And I don't think I am that man, but I don't know that I'm not. Bowie breathes and wonders what the fuck here is, but it seems singly true he's been in here for hours and hours. Breathes again, again. It's familiar like a remembered dream. I keep either losing or drinking my sodas. It's kind of funny. Remembered dream. Bites from an inner distance like that. Closer but not close enough. Looks again at the wall's writing. Beauty is sexual. Who? Some poet. Those years of reading poets, of really bothering over human wisdom. The shrooms laughed somewhere. It was sad giving it up, sad later when I'd see someone sitting with a book cradled, feeding brightly. You want it back, say the shrooms? Not everything gained is a comfort. Or lost? Fuck it, a trick. I know you don't like our language much. It's like wearing cuffs and blindfolds and choking airless and starving to death, say the shrooms. Funny, bastards. Pushes them away, thinks, this is before Preacher. Preacher was his partner when he was a spy. He was practically someone else living in some other world. Sam. Shit, Sam. This was the pisser in the hole they drank in. So long ago. He loved her. He loved her as he would not find possible anymore. Did they fuck? What counts as fucking? He never used to think of things like that. A punky girl before that got hip again. Scrawny, avoided food for days till suddenly they'd be at an all-night buffet loading up plates till thrown out. Her story was so confused he never knew it straight. Did they fuck? Why here now? Which now is it? Looks in mirror. Fucking Bowie. Beat to shit beautiful with his own brain stick. Preacher said that. Bowie nodded, one of his favorite possessions. The door back to the bar doesn't fit right in its frame. A trick to it. Push left, shove right, swings wide easy. Sitting there at her place at the bar, even drinking from her special glass the barman kept on a shelf for her. Her hair is cropped short. Never seen it short at all. Play through, Bowie. Nod and play the fuck through. She smiles. He loses some years. A flashing glance, not so scrawny. Gonna drink with me, Bowie? You never called me that. Still like your turkey wild? Barman pours. Tall one. How are you? Retches from his lips. I'm sorry. Sorry? I thought I knew shit, and I liked to talk shit, and I treated you like shit, and later my life went to shit. I did it to me, to you, to others. I'm sorry. Bowie studies his glass, does not sip yet. I took off for years, Bowie. You could have found me in Reno stripping for a while there. It felt good for a while. I didn't know how much I hated being poor until I had so much cash. I hoarded too for a while, but that wasn't good. Dancing, I felt present, like it mattered. Fucking men for money, I'd disappear. Nobody made me. I was treated pretty well. Nobody beat up on me. But I'd disappear, and that was wrong. They paid a girl, not a they paid for a girl, not a ghost. She drinks hard, taps for another. Then it gets weirder. I fell in love with one of the other dancers. Fell hard, like a fucking little puppy. Alessandra. I'd never really made love to a woman before, not like with her, not close. We had so much fun, pulled in so much cash when we danced together, made the patrons laugh, enjoy themselves like they never do. So unhappy, mostly, hungry and empty, and paying us to fill it with our bodies. I'd try to tell Alyssa what I saw, what I felt, but she knew. We danced together and something happened to them, and us, and nobody knew then, and I still don't know why now. We didn't even whore anymore, alone or together. Only a few strangers even asked. The regulars knew better, knew the gift in our dance. Some even took the feeling home and gave it to their wives and girlfriends. Kills her drink, nods another. Hell, the place got sold, and that was that. New owners wanted money-making legs, tits, and cunts. Alyssa said we're leaving and we're gone. We were gone. Remember that movie Thelma and Louise? Yeah, two crazy women on the road. We drove to the coast and then up a ways. Found a town and a little house and a garden and a fucking gazebo to drink beers at night with our fucking neighbors. She wanted a baby, wanted one with me. I said yes because I loved her and I wasn't ever going to stop. Shakes off another. Later. Silent like death. Well, it happened, but it was over between us. I left before he was old enough to know I'd ever been gone. Don't ask me why. Don't say a fucking word. I drove off till my old ass car collapsed. And then I took a greyhound and I came back home and he was there and alone and I climbed up on his hips like I used to after she'd finally left and I rode him till every drop came out. Bowie doesn't breathe. She means her ex-stepfather, the one who'd married and divorced her mother, and about a year later on her sweet, sweet 16th birthday, Sam always claimed when blind drunk, he fucked her raw into womanhood and they kept together and broke apart a few times. She might still have been fucking him when they'd been close before. Bowie'd met him once or twice. Mechanic. Body of a bull. Mind of a very nasty tyrant. I left him too, but it wasn't sad or nasty. We've talked on the phone a few times. Pauses. I've talked to Alyssa once. Now takes her drink. I even found God for a while, Bowie. It was like, okay, what's left? Anyway. She gets quiet. Story stops short. Why are we back here, Sam? I'm not sure, she lies. First one he knows she's told. Why aren't you drinking? You used to keep up for a while back then. He nods, does not sip. She sighs. I know you're mixed deep in some shit. Bowie says nothing. You know a place called Red Dog, chain of hippie restaurants started in the 60s? Nods briefly. I waitressed at one. This was years ago the first time and a few times since when I needed money. Like a cult, you can always go back once you've been. Pause. Why are you back here, Sam? You can stop. There's time. Stop what? There's a way out of this, Bowie. I can show you. You never called me Bowie. She smiles strangely. Think we have one more fuck in us? I've got more to tell, but not here. He stands. I've got plenty of fucks left in me, but not with you. Feels his heart crack some as he turns to walk away. You're just putting her in more danger. You know this. Who? Turns back, anger climbing over old regret. The girl. She doesn't fuck you like I did, but you're older now. A slower step in the bedroom. Catches himself, turns away, and walks out. Best you can do is leave it all and walk away alone. At least take her. You won't like what's coming. That was that little piece. She didn't know it would be like this and still wonders if it's so. There was another world, another life back there, back when, and it was a struggle. He said, too many gold coins in your head and nowhere to spend, and they pile up coldly year by year. She nods, wondering quietly, when he's gone some nights, how she spends them better now, or if much at all. And yet, there are moments he talks to her. He talks deep into her. He talks to places in her she'd hardly known before but in dreams. Places surely nobody else imagined or cared about. Yet he goes to them easily, does not charge as another man might, or simply take as many would. No, his purposes are not that easy or blunt. He knows, he teaches. She listens, disagrees if she wills. No rancor in it, none. But he knows things and she listens because her mind, full of unspent gold coins, will have no less. Calls the world an effect, how it leans in for a touch or a coin, something in purse or pants. She cringes a little, but nothing in it. He smiles and she relaxes, and she doesn't. Something trades back a heavy promise called God, or a sate of loins, or loneness, maybe a song in green. Songs in green, she says, I dream those. He nods. Perhaps he knows already, but his way isn't to treat dialogue like battle. Worse, he continues, world does not lead in. The hours pass silent on a carriage, in a cafe, a park, muted barks through wented walls. Jazz breathes in twice. Something happens. There is a smell of exhaust and baked bread. Opens her eyes. A city. What? No place she knows. She's sitting in a cafe courtyard at a black metal table. There are people around her talking. Know her. What? One. No. Her sister? No. This isn't real. She's in a shiny room in that hotel. Really, come on. It's okay, Jazzy. She smiles, that dear, frustrating, silly little sis-but-I-love-you smile. Don't be nervous, she whispers. These are my new college friends. I've told them you're cool. One eyes her and Jazz starts a little, peeking down. Fair amount plain to view, and her jeans feel watercolored on. Eyes her, then his gaze drifts easily away, and she finds herself wanting it back. She listens, but nothing makes sense, so she looks beyond this courtyard, to the traffic crowding by, the old stone buildings across the street. A street musician starts up on the sidewalk. Her sister sitting right there, and yet, if you keep chasing me, you will find trouble, Jazzy. I was there when the White Woods burned down long ago. They're gone. I didn't survive. You did. I made sure. I love you. She turns, confused. What the hell was that? Which, then, you ask, grows a heart kinder, unclenches those still-grabbing fists, no longer a babe's. Where is she? Who? My sister. I've told you, I don't know. Where is she? Sit down, Jasmine. Her wrist feels the cuff and the long chain, the pretty red dress with the side slit up high on her thigh, the sheer black hosiery beneath. Who? Sit. What? Sit. She sits. Neither resisting nor blandly yielding will win my favor. Says nothing. I know you hurt and hunger. Fuck, what has changed? The room is thickening with want. What she wears is worse than naked. A blunt invitation, not the helplessness of a weaker combatant. Stand. She does. Pose. She knows this means a shift of hips, hands cupping her breasts, wet lips. Again. She adjusts her straps, lets one fall halfway down her shoulder. He nods. The room strangely relaxes. You understand. No, she says, risking all. Good. Honesty pleases me. Tell me. He passed you along to me. Maybe I can help. She's quiet. You thought there would be no cost because I spoke kindly and did not brutalize you immediately. Waits. There's always a cost, Jasmine. Will you help me find my sister? I'll help you reach the White Woods. She said, I heard they burned down. Nothing destroys them. Nothing's like that. We can't. His voice is crackling, mingles with static like a distant radio station. What? Where? Near the window. That's good. The morning light on your skin is luminous. A large room, seems real enough. Her hair is down, arranged to look careless. She wears a long silk scarf, sky blue like her eyes. It wraps around her. He is painting her portrait on a large canvas, the one from the cafe courtyard. Where's my sister? You told me she went shopping with everyone else. You wanted to see my studio? You offered to pose? Is there something wrong? What's wrong is the absence of any concern in his voice. His sunburnt face ranges over her with a casual rage, like he would hurt her if he cared enough to. What store? She whispers. I'm not sure. I think she said the coop. Jazz nods and decides, lets the long scarf fall, risks all again. He starts. Are you going to hurt me? No. No. Pause. No, I love you, Jazz. Why do you do this? He moves near her, awkwardly. You can't explain why I'm here, can you? You're staying with your sister in North Cambridge. She's showing you around and we met. You told her you were staying a while. Why do I have to keep reminding you? He's scared. My sister is in the White Woods. She never got out. They never burned down. Am I there? Is this somewhere in the White Woods? She told me about that. It happened when you were younger. She was kidnapped, and you were too, but you both made it out. You're okay, Jazz. Jazz stands angry, bluntly naked. Will you tell me if I get into your bed with you? Tell you what? You've slept in my bed quite a few times. He's angry, but still a few feet away, angry and scared. She leans down to retrieve her long scarf and affixes it around her body again, notices a set of pink sneakers and slips into them, walks out his door to his protests, slams the door behind her. I'm in the White Woods now. He promised he would help me. I'm here, and I'm going to find her. Whatever this is, I will find her. The traffic is moving distantly from a coffee house's high window. And so who shows up in this? The characters that show up here were not previously in the story. They just appear here, like 600 pages in. And I don't know if they'll appear again. So it's interesting. The traffic is moving distantly from a coffee house's high window, and if I let cry my vision, I can reach there and dab it with my words and imaginings, call one of those sets of headlights driven by a hungerer, not a man, not quite a man, importantly, not quite a man. He drives the night on that highway toward a place that will answer him. The night is mildly cool, windows open, air blows in like night's sugared treat offered, and sometimes he lets his hands lax and fall, drives by suggestion, allows the car's innate will to consciousness to flare and thus its instinct to survive. It can drive itself. It can collaborate in this, if let, if believed, if trusted enough. He lets the car drive, lets it open out to full intention, and looks in the back seat to where precious Whistler rests on a small yellow pillow. Whistler, come from dreams. Whistler, who needs to make contact. Whistler, manifest in this world as a leaf deep in the White Woods. Whistler, are you fucking listening to me about this? Whistler comes from the White Woods. Whistler speaks, but only in reply, and only the same words as spoken. Does Whistler simply mime? No, he's decided after driving with Whistler for this long, and how his own thinking has changed about everything in that time. The ships are really overhead. Civilization does push faces en masse into the murk. Make sure each face faces many others. Make sure each face confuses the others with an idea of truth, of knowledge, of possessing something another lacks, of envy when not jealousy, of ideas that conflate difference with threat, of the possibility of one language tapping the music better than another, one ragged tome of letters and questions over another. Each face pushed to mass with some and not all, and want and want and want. Who is he before this trip is fragments? Unconnected and fairly important. What matters is that Whistler get to where he's bound and do what he's bound for doing. He or she, a joke, both, neither. The cries for knowing in these cars speeding on all sides of him. The hurry for gain or blood spent to plug loss. More than any of this, knowing the ships are up there, have always been up there. Knowing the murky mass of faces striding brightly in ignorance, raising high the reflections in civilization's thin puddle, calling to one another of one image or another. This is not what Whistler's about, what Whistler has taught him, how he has changed. The car has driven itself some miles now. Call it a happy creature as much as aught else. It was Whistler who made him see that to create anything intentionally was to breathe, share, give life to it. What kept all these cars around them obedient, dozing mindless of their own being, was how the will nearest them caged them in, how each car's dreamless sleep reached out and massed around each other's car's possible waking. kept cocooned in years in slavery. He laughs again. Whistler taught him language's snares and its open doors. Whistler taught him, but them not really. Who teaches a child to hunger, to want touch, to love music and sunshine, to fear a little the night and its potent surprises? But it began somewhere, and that's how it was early on. The night he passed out in the motel room, covered in shit and blood and common bourbon. What else? He didn't know. Passed out and was somewhere else. Best called other years. A bed with a pretty companion and about to fall asleep when a sound. A start. The dim room's light showing a movement on the bed. He wasn't in it now, but his companion was. Scared. A tiny movement across the bed covering a spider? Perhaps his companion cowered and he swept the tiny creature off the bed, and then, in fractured minutes, there was now a moth, a clumsily flapping being, growing larger? Larger, and now a bird, no longer a moth, a bird with a flat-topped head now landing on the bed, and he was told, that's Whistler, but by whom? Whistler lay now on a small yellow pillow, wet as though just hatched, yet able to fly. Whistler, indeed. More time, more fractured time, and the dream left, and the shat bloodied hotel room left, and this car in the highway and Whistler in the back seat on the yellow pillow, both from that dream. Now, how is that? What had happened? How did I know Whistler came from the White Woods? This is what I wondered. Wondered a lot. It was probably all that I still wondered about, or asked Whistler about when I discovered he could or was willing to communicate with me. White Woods? White Woods. What are they? What are they? Are we going there? Going there? I was thinking it's almost like Yoda, but not quite. Anyway, sometimes it got more complex than this, and I would get upset. I would feel the murk coming back and panic. Whistler did not do this to me. It was the questions, not asking them, but expecting something of them, bringing to questions nation answers, wanting to be right. But the White Woods was not something I had known familiarly back then, before this drive. It was what I dreamed about now, whenever I slept, though I didn't really call it sleep. I can only say things shifted, and after fractured times, I knew that Whistler was from the White Woods, and this was important, and there were other things to know, and I did not know them. We keep passing that billboard for Black Dog Diner, that exact one. I'm not sure anything is wrong, but gently take back control from the car and pull off the highway to near it. And I do it again, and I do it again. Then I stop doing this. I stop everything. We sit at the side of the highway, not far from the billboard, yet hardly off the road itself. There's a stasis now. Nothing repeats. Whistler? Whistler. Where now? Where now? Where now? I nod, but think harder. Forward or back? Forward or back? Thinking is getting me nowhere. Cars sound asleep to themselves, roar powerfully by. What then? What then? And someone at the bar says, because apparently people at Lunatees are watching this on the TV somehow. Barkeep, what the hell is this crap? This is like Herbie the Love Bug for potheads. Everyone at Lunatees Cafe's bar is restless and annoyed. Now what? When movement without isn't working well or at all, chance at movement within. Pull back from the external traffic and wreck its equivalent within. Blood, piss, bile within, music, sadness within, memories within, the steady of bones, warmth of skin and muscle. Perhaps the traffic between inner and outer, what pours out and in. Go slowly here. Go slowly. The murk is safe, a blinding, cozy womb. Move toward it now. Let to it now. A face among faces. Faces confirm, encourage. What else but faces? What else but faces? What else but faces? Faces? Faces. The car begins to move again. I let it, or rather do not try to stop it. We pass the Black Dog Diner billboard and eventually come to the Black Dog Diner itself. The car pulls in the far end of the parking lot and parks itself away from the few other cars present. I sit there for a moment. I don't remember leaving the car once since I don't remember entering it. Something like fear. I don't want to leave, Whistler. Leave, Whistler. I can't. Silence, no reply. I get out of the car, walk through the cool night to the Black Dog Diner, through its doors, into the murk of men, not knowing if I will lose into it again now that I have left Whistler in the car. I sit. A glass of water is on my table. A menu of words. I speak them without reading. I know the words already. I'm breathing hard. This is choking me. They clobbered them. They did not. I'm telling you, it was over by the fourth inning. Nothing to do but let the thing die an inning at a time. Fuck you, Jonesy. Hey, watch your language. God damn your piety. Now you're taking the Lord's name in vain. What Lord, Jonesy? Show me a Lord whose goddamn name I'm taking in vain. What does that mean anyway, take the Lord's name in vain? You tell me, preacher. Go to church or read your Bible. What church? I don't got a Bible. How about if I look at in this month's penthouse letters? Is the Lord not in those letters from lonely, horny people trying to make a connection, tell their story? Why do you always do this? What's your point? To make me feel bad? Show what a smart-ass mouth you really have? I already know. You don't believe anything ain't wiggling wet in your bed. Ha! Listen to Jonesy. Wiggling wet in my bed. Sounds pretty good, actually. I never asked. You got a sister, Jonesy? A daughter? A niece? A horndog neighbor? I leave then, there, now. I'm running back through the murk that is everywhere now. Whistler, whistler, I call and try to listen, and I hear nothing, and I call, and I call, and I call. I run, then I crawl, then I begin to cry, then I fall to the ground, and I pass out in my despair. When I come to, we are driving again. Whistler is in the back, and I know, never ask about the Whitewoods again. It's where he's from, where we're going, but if I want to keep with this, I can't ask. When next I sleep, or just lose into fractured time, I see a face and nothing else. Blue eyes, a kind young face, one that is not murky, that is clear and looking back at me, and this is where we are going, and we have to get there very soon.
Very good, Ray.